Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, in Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking with local chef Tyler Harold of Public Greens about working with local farmers, building a new menu, and finding springtime inspiration. We'll also head into the kitchen at Public Greens with Tyler for a Cook This segment. Today we'll also hear about a local company called Super Microgreens, which grows tiny shoots of all sorts of vegetables, from radishes and beets to daikon and kohlrabi. Super Microgreens owners Ian Mott and Ramey Lazarus tell us all about it. And this week we'll also catch up with tenderloin sandwich connoisseur Rick Garrett, who blogs at breadedtenderloins.wordpress.com. I met up with Rick and his wife Holly this week to get the backstory on how the blog came about, and to try a tenderloin sandwich from Chef Omar Guzman of Cobblestone Grill in Zionsville. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, we are definitely in the midst of a cold snap here in central Indiana, but it really is spring, I promise, and things are already growing and being harvested. And those fresh ingredients are already inspiring chefs. Chefs like Tyler Harold at Public Greens in Broad Ripple. I sat down with Tyler this week, right after a delivery of fresh produce from a local farm, to talk with him about sourcing ingredients, working with farmers, and finding inspiration in early spring. As far as sourcing and farmers and ingredients this time of year, what are you thinking about?
About 10 days ago, I got the first text about ramps. I think ramps are probably the first thing that comes. You know, they are, you know, wild, so they're on their own schedule, so to speak. As of Monday, I got my first text message about, non-wild stuff. And that was from, Twin Crook CSA. Actually, they were walking in when you got here. That's who dropped all the red bins. And they had beets and chard, spinach, arugula, a lot of your, you know, greens, green onions. We actually got scallions and leeks. We got overwintered scallions and leeks out of our out of the micro farm.
Oh, right here, like right on the Monon, did that. Oh, very cool.
They harvested all that stuff. That actually came last week, the week before. So kind of just, you know, starting to get back into radishes. Obviously, they're always one of the first ones. Kind of getting back in the swing of, you know, those sort of things, you know.
Do you get excited about these first ingredients, you know, the foraged ramps and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, ramps are always that's sort of the first thing, and that's always, to me, like, one of the signs of spring. And then radishes. Like, radishes are generally the first, like, cultivated, that and the greens, you know. I mean, I love it all, but you sort of, you know, the greens can only go so far. I mean, you know, like, yeah, it's kale and spinach and arugula and chard and, you know, but the first time you actually get, like, a radish, you know, an actual, like, something that's not just a leaf, you're like, okay.
Something solid and round and red, for heaven's sakes. It's red, you know?
Exactly, yeah. That's when it's like, okay, now, you know, we're kind of back to, you know, back to the fun stuff.
How does that inspire you as far as your food and the dishes you create?
I mean, it's a million percent, 100%. You know, all the menus I do are seasonal. I think it, you know, not only do you, you know, people always ask, or, you know, people ask about my cooking style or whatever, and, you know, a lot of times I'll just let, you know, I sort of tend to think that, you know, I let the ingredients just shine for themselves. And I think, you know, when you start with good ingredients, it doesn't take much. You know, it doesn't take a lot of sauces and crazy spices. I also think, you know, for me, cooking seasonally, you know, it does a service to, you know, the farmers and the other people that are, you know, that are working hard to bring us this stuff.
Now, you work with lots of farmers, probably, maybe more so than most other chefs.
Yep.
What's that like, and how does that influence how you cook?
It all boils down to communication. You know, it's a lot of communication back and forth between myself and them. At the very beginning, you know, meetings in the winter months about, you know, what to grow, how to grow it, you know, how much to grow it, you know, what can they sort of count on me or us to buy, you know, to grow that kind of stuff. And, you know, then once you sort of get into it, it's just a lot of back and forth communication. We had, you know, just already Monday, Silverthorn, Nate Parks sent me a text and said, hey, I've got spinach, arugula, radishes. I said, okay. Went a couple hours, talked, you know, decide what I wanted. I said, okay, bring me the radishes. A little bit later, he texted me and said, actually, I went out and checked on the radishes. Because of the wind on Saturday, it blew the tops off the hoop houses. So he basically lost all the radishes. So, I mean, it's a lot of that sort of thing, you know, weather and bugs and God knows whatever else, deer coming and eating heads of lettuce and you know, whatever else.
So you have to, adjust, you know, so you're probably constantly adjusting what you're thinking about.
Exactly. And, you know, I adjust with them and they adjust with me. If we get, you know, if I get a catering, you know, that pops up and I'm like, okay, well, now we need 75 spinach salads. Like, okay, hey, I told you earlier, like, I wanted 10 pounds. Now I need 15 pounds. You know, can you do that or can you make that happen? And that, you know, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of, you know, not just picking up the phone and calling a produce company that you can call until 12 o'clock at night, and then they show up the next day with this perfect box of whatever, and here you go. Actually, it's not always perfect, but it's in a box, at least.
So that must be a lot of extra work for you just as you create each menu.
Not even so much, even more so not just a menu, but just a day-to-day. And I mean, I don't know if that's cliche to say, but I mean, I think it's worth it. I think it's, I talk to a lot of farmers. I talk to a lot of different, you know, sort of people who ask about this and ask, like, well, why, you know, how do you do it or why do you do it or what's the, you know, and I think, you know, it really boils down to two things. One, you know, because of the support from Martha and her never wavering on price, you know, to her, she wants the best possible products we can get. And, you know, so I have that luxury to be able to do that, and also the buying power of 10 restaurants. And to me, it's a lot about the personal relationships that you develop with those farmers and knowing their names and their kids' names and their pets' names and their children's names and their background and, you know, sort of, and salespeople are the same way, don't get me wrong, you know, but it makes it more real when you sort of know them and have been to their farm and seen how they do it, and, you know, they pull up in a beat up truck and, you know, they still have their overalls on or whatever, you know, you sort of, you know, I guess, I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but, like, we work really long hours in the restaurant industry, and it's you're always on your feet, and it's hard, and it's hot, and it's sweaty, and it's nasty sometimes, and farming is a lot alike, you know, so you sort of relate to them.
Well, sure. So there's a you know, a kinship there, you know, and I'm sure, you know, because you're taking their products that they have, you know, cared for all along the way, right. And then you're doing something wonderful with them. So that must be a nice thing too.
It is. It totally is, and that's something that I sort of, when I get new cooks, I will sort of, it's sort of my little like circle of life thing. You know, I want them to know that, you know, this starts way back in, you know, November, December. You know, there's a meeting, and then we talk about what we're going to get, and then, you know, they have to order seeds, and then they have to get the seeds, and then they have to plant the seeds, and then they have to transplant the seeds, and then they have to weed the seeds and water the seeds, and the weather has to all be perfect, and the deer have to not come in there, and the raccoons don't have to come in there, and then they have to pick it, and then they have to wash it, and then they have to box it, and then I have to text them and say what I want, and they have to text me, I got it. Then they drive it to us. Then we get it. And
so that's a process.
It's a huge process, and I want every single person that works for us to know that every time that you maybe forget about something and it goes bad, or every time that we get a box of tomatoes and you just kind of throw it, you know, you don't store it right, you don't store it correctly, and we lose something, you didn't just lose a, you know, a tomato or whatever. Think about all the hours and the work and the time that went into that, whatever it may be.
We've been talking with Potashew Inc. Executive Chef Tyler Harold, who handles menu development and kitchen management for all Cafe Potashew, Petit Chou, Napoli, Gillo, and Public Greens restaurants. We'll be back with Tyler with a Cook This segment here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. At Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we occasionally get the chance to head into the kitchen with a local chef for our Cook This Challenge. The way it works is I choose an ingredient, stop by a local chef's kitchen, and see what he or she comes up with. This week, I picked up some very seasonal ramp and potato sausages from Goose the Market and headed into the kitchen at Public Greens with Chef Tyler Harold, executive chef at Potashew Inc., to find out how he would prepare them.
I obviously always think, or try to think, seasonal. You know, they always say, like, what grows together goes together. So, you know, there's a reason why tomatoes and basil go together, and apples and butternut squash, and, you know, all that fun stuff. So, today we have ramps and potatoes. So I'm thinking, obviously, something springy. So maybe some peas and some asparagus. Maybe some leeks, maybe even throw in some rhubarb, raw rhubarb for some crunch and some, you know, acidity.
What kind of influences are you thinking beyond spring? Is the, you're thinking a, you know, a certain type of cuisine or a certain type of spice or any kind of flavor profile that's coming to mind already?
I really wish we had some. So, oh, you know, let me look in the herb bin here. So yeah, and as far as like cuisines go, probably nothing too like out there. To me, this seems pretty. American, for lack of a better way to say it. American, you know, it's not too like. I don't really want to take it in any sort of international or ethnic route. So maybe just, I would really love some tarragon, but we don't have any, or maybe some chervil, but we don't have any. So dill is probably going to be what I'm going to go with. Maybe some mint, you know, the sort of, starchy potatoes, you know, obviously the ramps are the allium, sort of family. So yeah, and I think, not to sound cliche, but since we're at Public Greens, I'll probably make a salad. That's kind of what we have, you know, the most of, or at least sort of what lends itself best here.
So what direction are we going?
So, well, it's still going to be sort of like a salad, but it's going to be warm, more like a warm, like, grain bowl or salad or something like that. Maybe something you could eat for breakfast, you'd eat for lunch, you'd eat for dinner, probably any any or all of the above. So I'm going to start. I'm just going to throw these on the grill real quick.
Get some grill marks, get some char, get some of that grill flavor.
So what do you have here all set up?
Cool. So we've got just some peas, some leeks, some kale, some black barley, some asparagus, and some rhubarb. Then I've got a little bit of dill and parsley over here. So I'm just going to take this.
When you think of a dish, when you start to see a dish in your head, where do you start?
Good question. Probably with like, yeah, you sort of go with one ingredient, or you go with one. I generally go maybe from one ingredient and kind of branch out off of there. So like, if we're gonna do like Brussels sprout, then you sort of start with that main ingredient or vegetable or protein or whatever it may be, and then you sort of just kind of branch out from there and go, okay, well, what's gonna play well with this?
Well, I was wondering about the rhubarb. You know, most people, you know, if you say rhubarb, they're gonna think pie, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and not as an ingredient to eat.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously, I think it's about, you know, anytime you're making a dish or anytime I'm making a dish, I think anybody, any chef would say, you know, it's about flavor and textures and balancing things out and you know, salty and sweet and bitter and acid and fat and, you know, all those sort of things that you sort of have to have that balance. You know, you don't want something that's, you know, like when we do a salad, we don't want a bunch of, you know, soft thing. You know, you need crunch and you need, you know, you need all those sort of things intermingling to do that. And I, especially now, this time of year, I think rhubarb, there's nothing like it. I mean, there's nothing that really has that sort of flavor, that sort of soury, crunchy, sweet, you know. So I'm like, why not?
Now, what's the grain that you've got again?
So that's black barley.
So what are you doing now?
So basically, I'm going to do sort of a warm, like a warm grain bowl salad type thing. And then we're going to, so basically I'm going to saute up the vegetables, add the grain. We'll add the fresh herbs at the end. We'll toss it all together, throw it in a bowl. We'll slap a Sunny Up egg on top and call it good.
What do you have there?
Leeks. So these are just some diced up leeks. We have the rhubarb. Start the egg. I did the leeks first, sort of as kind of like a, you know, like you would an onion or a garlic, and then I'm sort of just going with the hardest, the crunchiest stuff next. Do a little kale. We'll throw in our black barley. I'm actually going to put in a little water. Peas. All right. I'm going to grab our herbs.
Tell me what you're looking for, what you taste for, that sort of thing.
I'm just tasting it. See how it needs, you know, see if it needs more salt, see if it needs more acid, see if it needs more fat, etc. I think we're good on acidity. I'm going to add a little bit more salt because I think it needs it. I also think we are going to finish it. The rhubarb definitely adds some sourness, some astringency. So to cut that, I'm going to add everybody's favorite thing and favorite ingredient,
butter.
So we're going to throw a knob of butter in there, and then we'll just kind of give this a stir. Stir it all up. butter will help with richness and fat. I think this with, you know, the sausage probably doesn't have a ton of fat because of the potato. So we'll walk over here and go with our fresh herbs.
Okay, it is really smelling good right now.
Yeah, that's a good time. So we'll just plate it up here. Looks like spring, I think, yeah.
Put those nuts on there for crunch.
These are just some walnuts. And then we'll cap it off. And that's it.
All right, now, sort of talk me through it again. Tell me what you put together and how it all ended up.
So so basically we started with the potato and ramp sausage sort of as the, you know, what to play off of. Thought spring, you know, what can we do to sort of play off the spring flavors in the ramps. Basically went with a lot of spring vegetables. We sauteed up some leeks. We threw some rhubarb in there to give it kind of shake things up a little bit, give it a little bit of a tang, give it some crunch. We added some kale, added some asparagus, sort of sauteed up all those things first. They're the most, you know, they need the most time sauteing, softening up, so to speak. We added in our grain, which was, this was black barley. Got that to where we needed to be, seasoned it with salt and pepper, added a touch of water, kind of loosened things up a little bit, tasted it, needed a little bit more fat, added in a little bit of butter to give it richness, to give it fat, finished it off with the fresh herbs at the very end, kind of keep that flavor intact, put it down, put a little, just some chopped walnuts on top for some crunch, finish it off with a Sunny Up egg. So we have a sort of a vegetable grain bowl, so to speak, with an egg on top, maybe for breakfast or for lunch or for dinner.
I think it looks good for just about anything. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Whenever, whenever you're in the mood for those flavors.
We have been cooking with Chef Tyler Harold in the kitchen at Public Greens in Broad Ripple. To find out more about Tyler, go to puttashooinc.com and check out the Public Greens menu at publicgreensurbankitchen.com. Farmers market season will be starting soon, and one item that you will likely see more of this year are microgreens. Now, I've been noticing more and more examples of the tiny vegetable shoots at local farmers markets, so I decided to find out more. Earlier this week, I got to see how the tiny plants are grown at Super Microgreens in Indianapolis. Rami Lazarus and Ian Mott, who have been working several years to bring their nutrient-packed greens to the Indianapolis market, explain how they are growing year-round in downtown Indianapolis and just what the reaction has been to the flavorful little plants.
We were originally looking into aquaculture, and we wanted to feed the fish the most nutritious food we could, and we found microgreens. And then we realized that we just wanted to do microgreens, and we did 2.5 years of R&D, and then we opened up Super Microgreens to sell those greens to the public.
So what's been the reaction?
Across the board, it's been really positive. Everybody has enjoyed the product. What we always say is the reason we're in this industry is because the product sells itself. If I can get somebody to taste the product, that's usually all it takes.
Now, when they taste it, what are they going to taste? Because, you know, they're tiny. It's hard to imagine that there is a lot of flavor there, but I think that's kind of a false assumption, right?
Right. You think small, you think you're not going to get that explosion of flavor that you do. My favorite example is the beets. I always say they're beety because it tastes like you have a mouth full of beets and you've only put one tiny little strand in there. So I always say you're going to get earth notes, you're going to get background notes, you're going to get more of a full flavor than you would with the full-grown counterpart. And it's kind of counterintuitive.
It is from that tiny little bite, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you look at our mustards and stuff, one little piece of mustard on a sandwich tastes like a whole bunch of mustard. And so that ability to use a garnish and have it actually affect the flavor of the meal, I think, has expanded people's minds. And so when you use them on tacos and things, instead of a garnish as a part of that flavor, it brings out the other flavors of the fish or the meat because it gives that background note.
Tell me a little bit about the time frame, you know, of creating the company. You talked about the research and development time that it took. How did you learn about all of this?
We built a system in my home, and we tested every variable independently, basically. We designed a series of experiments, and we tested water levels and different lights and control systems and timing schedules. We really wanted to look at each variable independently and optimize them. And so that's why we spent so much time, is we wanted to not just produce a product and a system, but be able to produce it efficiently and sustainably. So we were able to get the water down 95 to 98% less than the full-grown crop outside, 500 watts to grow over 10 pounds of greens a day. When you compare those with other methods, our efficiencies are much higher, and that's because we spent that time to not just get a way that works, but get a way that works and is sustainable and efficient.
So now, in case people really aren't aware of how and where they're growing, this is inside, and you're getting so much production out of a fairly small space.
So it's a 12 by 4 foot rack, is a single system. That'll produce 10 pounds of greens a day every day of the year.
Every day, 10 pounds.
Yeah, so 365. If you say you want greens every Thursday, we will cut fresh greens every Thursday for you. And so it's in a warehouse. There's no windows. It's humidity and temperature controlled. We maintain the highest cleanliness standards. So that makes it different because we're giving you a consistent product every day of the year. If you grow outside, you grow in a hoop house, a greenhouse, nature's inputs are variable. The light that you're getting is not the same. Our plants are the same every day of the year because they had the same conditions. And that is a very big difference.
Now, how do you develop the type of plants that you have, the type of greens that you have? You know, how do you pick from all the things that are available?
We source our all GMO-free seeds, and, you know, we look at what a lot of trends are in other marketplaces. I mean, Indianapolis is seen as growing, you know, quickly. So, you know, we're looking at where the trends are being set and trying to get ahead of the curve here. So anything from kale to cabbages, chards, you know, all of them have such unique and different colors and flavors that, you know, the 30 or so varieties that we keep on hand really allows us to dial something in for what each chef's looking for rather than just going and saying, I want a container of microgreens. It's like, I'd like a container of red acre cabbage mixed with mustard, and you get that perfect color and flavor.
Now, what are some of the microgreens that you have that people might not be aware of? You know, we see the little shoots or maybe the pea shoots in restaurants, but I think it goes way beyond that.
I mean, there are some really unique flavors out there, and those unique flavors, you know, such as like a curled cress, something you never really think about, especially in a microgreen, but we got our hands on some of those seeds and found out that, wow, this has a naturally smoky flavor for a green. You know, it's something that's a flavor profile that's either artificial or requires, you know, a lot of process. And this is something where you could add just a little bit of it to get that little bit of a hint of smoke, which is always really nice. I mean, micro chives, micro daikon radish is really popular. You're seeing that all over the place. That just has such a unique bite to it, even with just one or two of them laid across something as a garnish.
So where does the company go from here? You know, it seems like that there's so much growth potential.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're creating demand right now. We're creating awareness and demand, and so we're working on products. We're making all sorts of things with the microgreens, with partners that we're working with in town. So coleslaws, mustards, infused vinegars, our supplements, we're working on pasta partnerships, we're working on sausage partnerships. We've talked to people about making fresh juices. So I think as we expand, as the awareness and the demand expands, we're going to try and get it into every product, every meal, every restaurant that we can, because it's the best way for those restaurants to get flavor and nutrition and color into their food locally.
Tell me a little bit about the nutritional value of what you're growing.
So the FDA has been doing research for over 20 years now into microgreens, and they've sort of been on the cutting edge, which is why it's getting popular on both coasts. So if we take red acre cabbage, for example, every nutrient that's in there is 4 to 40 times higher. So the protein in our micro cabbage is 40 times higher than the protein in the regular cabbage.
So now tell me a little bit more about some of the partnerships that you mentioned.
Well, we've been working with Bettini Pasta in trying to invent some cool, you know, very nutrient-rich and unique colors that are all natural for some pastas and some different raviolis. So that's been kind of an ongoing process for the last few months. We're trying to really dial something cool and unique in. And, you know, microgreens in a pasta is just one more way to, you know, get that out in front of people and really capture those unique flavor profiles. We're also doing a custom sausage for Smoking Goose, where we're going to be growing daikon radish micros and red giant mustard that they're going to be using in a sausage that will be available at the meat locker sale that's coming up this month.
So an interesting partnership is You Relish, which makes crock pot meals here in town, is going to use the red acre cabbage as a protein addition to their crock pot meals. Some of their meals that are lower in protein, she's going to be able to use that as an enhancement. So in that case, you're more using the product for the nutrients that it has in it than the flavor or the color. In this case, those are just going to be a bonus. But yeah, just send us an email or give us a call. You can order directly and we'll set up a pickup or a delivery time. And
now, tell me just a little bit about pricing, sort of maybe the price range of some of the greens.
So that's one beautiful thing about our system is they're all the same price. You pay per tray. We have a 2-foot by 1-foot tray. We put a certain amount of seeds into that tray. You get everything that came out of that tray because it was grown specifically for you. And our trays are all $20 except for some of our one-off specialty trays. Like we have a divided tray that's got 16 different varieties, and that's a little bit upcharge for the labor. But all of our trays are $20.
Then are there smaller sizes available maybe for retail?
There are several locations around town, Goose the Market, Country Nutrition, that sell small 2-ounce clamshells to the public.
One other really cool thing that we're doing, I believe it's next weekend on the 16th, we're going to be at the Smoking Goose's Meat Locker sale. We're actually in the middle of doing a collaboration sausage with them, which will be for sale at that sale, as well as doing some demoing and kind of giving more information about microgreens and doing some samples. So that should be pretty fun.
We have been talking with Ian Mott and Rami Lazarus of Super Microgreens. For more information on the power-packed little plants, go to supermicrogreens.com. If Indiana has a signature food, it has to be the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. That's certainly the viewpoint of the very popular blog at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com written by the tenderloin connoisseur, musician and comedian Rick Garrett. I try to catch up regularly with Rick to find out what he's up to, and this week I met him at the Cobblestone Grill in Zionsville to try a tenderloin from Chef Omar Guzman. And while we were there, I got to hear about how the whole idea for a tenderloin blog came about from Rick's wife, Holly.
So we were dining out together at a little local restaurant right around the corner from our house. We had never been there before, and we wanted to try it because it was local. We always like to go local when we can. And so we went in, and he chose the tenderloin sandwich, as he does often. I mean, before this ever happened, he always got the tenderloin on the menu. And I don't know, I got like chicken quesadillas or something. So he was talking about how amazing the sandwich was and how good it was. And he was talking about it in detail, like describing the breading and the meat and how they worked well together. And I said, you know, you should start a tenderloin blog, you should start reviewing these and putting them out there, because there's tenderloins have a huge following, especially in Indiana and the Midwest, and you could be, you know, you could get some really good information out there to some people that are wondering where is the best tenderloin around. And so he said, wow, that's a really good idea. And he started doing some research and thinking about it and mulling it over. And lo and behold, the Tenderloin Connoisseur was born.
So what do you think about the success of the blog and how it's kind of become a thing?
I'm utterly excited for Rick and the fact that so many people, he gets tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of hits on his page from people all across the United States, all around the world, servicemen overseas that crave the tenderloin that they remember from home, and they love to read about it and live vicariously through Rick trying all these tenderloins.
Now, Rick, did you expect the tenderloin blog to take off when you started it?
No, I really didn't. I kind of thought it would be one of those things. It would be fun to do for a while. There wouldn't be a lot of interest, and it would be like, well, I got to do this, and it was fun, but there's no reason to carry on. But it took off almost immediately. People started sharing the blog pages, and I started getting emails.
Now, what do you think about the claims that Indiana sort of invented the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich? Do you think that has credence?
I do. I think that's pretty accurate. And, you know, Nick's up in Huntington has kind of laid claim to that as theirs. But Indiana was, for those that may not know, the tenderloin generally accepted that it came from the German schnitzel, and they used pork, breaded it. Indiana was heavily settled by Germans in the early day, German Baptists, and breaded meat was a staple of their diet. So I think that's probably pretty accurate. They came to Indiana before they did to Iowa because we're farther east. So I think that's a pretty good claim.
That's true, because Iowa does also have tenderloin sandwiches. You see them there.
They do. And interestingly enough, the ones I've had in Iowa have been very different from the ones in Indiana.
Oh, my goodness. No, well, now, what's the difference?
Well, Indiana tends to have, as a general rule, the thicker tenderloins. I found the ones in Iowa to be more fritter-like, really, really thin, paper thin. And I don't like those because you can't distinguish between the texture of the breading and the meat. For me, food's a lot about texture. I like to feel the different textures in my mouth.
Well, I think that's part of why the tenderloin, for me, seems like such a great sandwich, because it does have that built-in crunch.
It does, it does. Boy, there's just not much more satisfying than a good crunch, is there?
Ideally, you have the tender meat, which isn't too thick, not too thin. You know, you have the crunch of the breading, and ideally, of course, the breading stays on, and the breading has some flavor in itself. But what sort of things do you look for in a tenderloin?
Well, the biggest thing is I don't like a sandwich where the breading gets soggy. So it's got to have some consistency that stays flaky and crisp throughout the life of the sandwich. Sometimes for me that can be a little time, because I like to talk while I eat. So I like that. I like it a little thicker, not pounded out paper thin. And I don't like dry meat. I like it to be moist. I think that's an important part of the sandwich.
And probably a hard thing to come across, because I'm guessing you've had some pretty so-so tenderloins.
I have. I've had some that's... That sounded really good. There's the restaurant I won't mention, but they use potato chips in their breading.
Okay, it has potential.
I thought that sounded pretty good, but it was just all soggy. You know, it just became soggy almost immediately. My pet peeve is a restaurant that advertises a breaded tenderloin but serves you a fritter, which is a pre-processed ground-up meat patty with breading on top of it.
Ooh, and you know them because, you know, they're shaped so perfectly,
exactly.
You know.
It looked like a hockey puck, you know, perfectly round. There's a restaurant up in Muncie, Indiana, Richard's Restaurant, that actually has a breaded tenderloin and a fritter on their menu. And in talking to them, they've said it's almost 50-50. So many people grew up eating those fritters, they like those.
Tell me what some of the reactions have been then from the owners of places that you've been to.
Oh, gosh, reactions from restaurant owners. Well, the overwhelming one is if I rate a review really high, their business goes up. And so I've had a lot of owners that have contacted me and said, you know, we are so appreciative of this. And I don't, you know, I don't do this for money. This is just something that I love to do. One of the things I get a lot is I'll have owners contact me and say, let me know when you're coming so I can fix you a tenderloin. And I really try to be anonymous. You know, I mean, I want to get the experience that the customer has when he goes in. So I may say, well, I'll be in sometime, but I will never, like, set up an appointment or let them know that I'm coming. And I'll usually purposely wait a month or two after they email me before I pop in.
That's why, well, now today is unusual, mm-hmm. because we're going to talk to the chef, you know, so that's a little different from your usual method, right?
It is. Typically, I don't tell them. I have a business card that says a tenderloin connoisseur and says you've been rated, and I'll have it up in 48 hours, and I just leave that with my tip when we leave, so.
Well, no, that's kind of fun. You know, any negative reactions?
I've had a couple. I've had some people say that I was not fair in my review to them. I think your reviewer is always going to get that at some point, you know. But I really do try to be honest, and I think I'm pretty generous with my reviews.
Do you ever go back and try a place again?
I do. I've went back and re-reviewed some. I've actually had two restaurants that I have on my list right now that have contacted me that are now under new ownership, and they've said, you know, we did not get very favorable reviews. Would you consider coming back and trying us with the current owner? And I certainly will do that. I just don't tell them when I'm going to do it.
Now, of course, Nick's Kitchen in Huntington claims to be the very first tenderloin, the whole birthplace of the breaded pork tenderloin. Tell me about that. Have you been there?
I have been there. That was review number 100. Holly and I took the day off and drove up to have lunch there. And if you like history and you like tenderloins, you got to go. It's probably really is the birthplace of it. You know, the tenderloin was good. There was not really anything that set it apart from any other tenderloin, but it was good. The pie was amazing. Sugar cream pie is number two on my favorite food list, and it was amazing. But it was a cool experience. Lots of neon, and everybody up there is friendly, and it's a great trip. You should really go.
We've been talking with Rick and Holly Garrett about Indiana's quintessential sandwich, the breaded pork tenderloin. We'll be back to talk more about tenderloins with Rick here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches have become an Indiana specialty. And local musician and comedian Rick Garrett is such a fan of the iconic sandwich that he started a blog about it. You can read his reviews of tenderloins from across the state at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. But today I talk with Rick about all the attention that being such an outspoken tenderloin fan has brought him.
I've been playing music for 40-plus years. I'm a stand-up comedian, have traveled all over, played with some amazing people and in amazing places. But when I get stopped on the street, when somebody recognizes me, it's not from TV or from playing music. It's always, you're the tenderloin guy. I can't count the times people have just, and not just around here, sometimes other places too, mm-hmm. you know. So the readership is really, really wide. I just broke 250,000 hits on the blog.
So, oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Wow. So, I kind of watched my weekly stats, but I hadn't looked at the cumulative stats for a while. So that was kind of interesting. That's a lot of people reading about tenderloins. But, you know, I think, and I've said this before, I think it's one of those foods that identifies us as Hoosiers, you know, kind of like barbecue for Kansas City and the Creole food in Louisiana and poutine way up north in Canada. I think it's kind of identifies us as Hoosiers. And you know, I think it's a sandwich that is the way that I think about a Hoosier person. It's not showy, but boy, it's good. It's not, you know, it's not ostentatious. It's not pretentious. It's just good.
Well, now, you know, there is the whole hugeness of some of the tenderloins. So there is that. And then the cute little bun on top.
Yeah, it's kind of like the clown with the little bitty hat on top, you know. And, you know, actually, I'm not a fan of those that are pounded out so thin they look like a hubcap. I like a little meat in my sandwich, you know. But, yeah, I always get a kick out of seeing the ones that have the little bun and then, you know, like.
Now, I did try one not too long ago that was very large, but it came with a very large bun, too, and that was the first one I had seen like that.
I've seen a couple of those. There's a diner on the south side that's kind of a 50s-style diner on South Shelby. I think it's just called the Shelby Street Diner. They have the really large bun. I like big buns, and I cannot lie.
Okay, tell me about the process.
So when the sandwich first comes out, Rick surveys the sides and the plate itself, kind of puts it together so that it makes a nice photograph, and he takes a picture of the whole thing. He eats his tenderloin with three toppings, mayonnaise, ketchup, and onion. And that's it. So he surveys how many onions he got, if there was a generous portion or not, and the other things that come with it, the condiments. And so then he takes a picture of it in its entirety, and then what he does is he cuts off the first piece and gives it to me so that I can also try the tenderloin, and then we talk about it and discuss the texture and the flavors and things together. That's we do them, you know, together, but then he does the whole sandwich once it's done.
So we're at the Cobblestone Grill in Zionsville. Chef Omar Guzman has created our tenderloins this evening. So tell me, what's your first impression of the tenderloin here?
Well, first of all, it's obvious it's not a fritter because it's misshapen. And in the case of tenderloins, misshapen is a good thing. You don't want it to be uniform, cut out like a cookie cutter. The breading looks really nice. It's evenly coated all over the sandwich. There's not bare spots in it. Crisp on the edges, a little not so crispy on the inside. Typically, I like a thicker tenderloin. This one is pounded out a little thicker than I prefer, but that's just personal preference. And so I cut two pieces off, gave one to my wife so that she can try it. The flavor is really good. The meat is nice and moist. The breading is crispy. Lots of condiments, so I like it. So far.
Do you sometimes run into tenderloins that are disappointing, maybe?
I do, and, you know, I have people recommend restaurants to me all the time. And I always feel bad when a friend tells me, you know, go check out this place. It's the best I've ever had, and I walk in, and it's just awful. I always feel bad about that. I think the most overrated one in Indianapolis is the Mug and Bun drive-in, because it's not a tenderloin. It's a pre-processed pork fritter. Don't get me wrong, I love the Mug and Bun. I love the history behind it. I love the root beer. It's just
the root beer is great.
Oh, the root beer is amazing. Onion rings are great. But don't get the tenderloin.
Now, are there places that are still on your list that you want to try?
Oh, sure. There's quite a few. Big Daddy's down on South Meridian. That sounds like a really good one I want to try. There's one in Greenwood called That Place. And places pop up all the time. So I've done about 135 or so reviews. So there's lots more to try. One of these days I would like to take just a few days. My wife and I take off and start up at South Bend and work our way down to Evansville, then over to Cincinnati, then up the eastern side of the state and just do a tenderloin tour. Maybe I should start a GoFundMe for... Would you like to donate to the tenderloin tour?
Well, that's promising. You know, that has potential. Now, tell me about, maybe, have you seen tenderloins in your travels, you know, in other places, in other states?
I have, and we always are looking to find some. The farthest west I have found one is in St. Charles, Missouri. It was a little bar that we visited out there when we were out on a music tour, and it was served on a hoagie bun, so it was long and narrow, but it was really pretty good. I've had tenderloins in Iowa. I don't think I have. I do know they exist in Illinois, but I don't recall if I found one in Illinois or not. Have not found one in Ohio yet, but I understand there are a few out over there. And I've found some real regional differences in tenderloins. Iowa tends to be a lot more flat, pounded out thinner. Indiana typically tends to be thicker. Indiana has quite a few places that have a tenderloin served with gravy, which I thought was kind of interesting. Served as kind of like an open-faced wet sandwich. And we were someplace recently, and I wish I could remember where it was, but they were offering a Cajun breaded tenderloin that they put Cajun spices in the breading.
Well, now that could be interesting. And, you know, I've seen sort of, you know, tenderloin biscuits and gravy combinations.
Right, yeah. And that's it's actually a fairly popular breakfast dish. I know the Goldfinch Restaurant in Brookville has tenderloin and eggs for breakfast, and I've seen a few others also.
Well, I suppose it kind of goes along with that sort of chicken fried steak kind of
thing. Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Chicken fried, yep. Schnitzel, chicken fried steak, that kind of thing. So it's been a couple of sandwich shops pop up in Florida serving them because we have so many Indiana retirees down there. I do know there's one in Fort Myers and one in Eustis, Florida, which is kind of a suburb of Orlando that I've read about. So when we make our Florida trip, we'll have to try some Florida tenderloins.
So tell me about some national media attention.
Well, I've actually had a little bit of that. There's a food writer out of Chicago named Kevin Pang. I don't know if you know Kevin. Kevin actually came down and spent a whole day with me in Indianapolis trying pork tenderloins. Did a full-page spread on me and pork tenderloins. And I just got a call yesterday, I think it was, from a writer for the USA Today, who is starting to do a series of regional foods. So they're coming into Indianapolis on Thursday, and we're going to have lunch and talk about breaded tenderloins. And then they're going out to Kansas City and do barbecue and south and do Cajun food. So I've actually got a fair amount of national media attention, which was not something that I anticipated. One of the highlights was Ted Allen from the Food Network was in town, and we got to spend some time with him. And he was a really nice fella. I really enjoyed them.
We have been talking with the tenderloin connoisseur, Rick Garrett. You can find out more about Rick's music and comedy at rickgarrett.net and read all those tenderloin reviews at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. This is Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. And thanks also to our guests, Chef Tyler Harold of Public Greens, Rami Lazarus and Ian Mott of Super Micro Greens, and Rick and Holly Garrett of breadedtenderloins.wordpress.com, and Chef Omar Guzman of the Cobblestone Grill in Zionsville. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.